So tonight we're continuing in this six-week course on the Four Noble Truths, and tonight I want to speak about the second noble truth. This is about knowing the arising of dukkha. What causes things to be unsatisfactory, unreliable? Or what causes suffering in the classic translation? And we have to remember that there's like these two layers of this. There are things that are just inevitably happen to us. We get old, we get sick, you know, stuff happens, we're in an accident, someone rear-ends us, we lose our job because of foreign competition, who knows? You know, stuff happens, right? And our life gets turned upside down. And that's just life, and there's nothing, I'm not saying that we can make that go away or fix that. So what we can work with, what we're trying to do instead is to work intelligently with it so that we don't stick ourselves with what's called the second dart, where not only do things happen, but then we create our own misery, wailing and complaining and thinking it's not fair or whatever we do. And so, but what is it that we habitually do that creates the second dart over and over and over again? And once again, the Buddha was very, very simple. He said the cause of dukkha is tanha, which translates roughly as grasping or craving. It's often you see this tanha also translated as desire. And this is not that correct. Because a desire can be wholesome or unwholesome or totally neutral. You know, you had a desire to come here this evening. This is a wholesome desire. You know, you could have had a desire to go, you know, go to a kegger instead. This might have been an unwholesome desire. Right? So, and this is just, we make choices all the time based on when something arises. Oh, I can do this or I can do that. You know, so grasping, on the other hand, has a note of desperation. Yeah, no, it wouldn't be nice if. It's now. It's like I have to have it, or I have to get, or I have to get away from it. You know. Sometimes you see it also translated as thirst. This overwhelming desire. And the reason that this is such a big problem is, and this is in the classical teachings on the 12 steps of codependent arising, which I want to spend a little time talking about right now, is that grasping inevitably leads to what's called clinging, which is now I'm not just trying to get a hold of it, I've got a hold of it and I'm holding on really tight. And so the 12 steps of codependent arising, first of all, what the heck is codependent arising? Basically, codependent arising states this very simple premise. If A happens, then B will inevitably happen. And vice versa. If B has happened, A must have happened. So it's connected in both directions. Okay, so in the 12 steps of codependent arising, we start with what causes and conditions. You know, causes and conditions arise such that we experience something. Something arises at one of our sense doors, whether it's the physical sense doors or at the mental door. And then, once that happens, always, without fail, the mental formation of Vedana arises. Vedana being roughly translated as feeling tone. And you know, Vedana only has three valences, three possibilities. It's pleasant, it's unpleasant, it's neutral. It's a very momentary sort of flicker in the mind of ugh, or yippee, or who cares? You know, one of those three things happens, right? But Vedana, when we don't see it for what it is, we don't notice it, tends to lead us towards craving. Yeah. Something arises, it's pleasant, we crave to have more of it, to hold on to it, what we've got. Something arises and it's unpleasant, and we crave to push it away. Don't want that. Want to ignore that. And if it's neutral, you see, the interesting thing about neutral is if something's neutral, then what happens is we go, oh God, who cares? It's so boring. We space out and we go looking for something that has more juice. And often when we go looking, we don't care whether it's pleasant or unpleasant. We just want some action, please. Give me something that catches my attention, right? And so craving arises, and then craving leads directly to clinging. Clinging, meaning you've now got a firm grip. I'm going to hold on to this really tight. So if it's something, and the problem, of course, is we're holding on to it, thinking we can keep it, thinking it'll always be there. Yeah, and from what we talked about last week, well, we know that everything's impermanent. So there's no way, no matter how tightly we cling, that's going to be, things are going to stay this way. It's inevitably going to change. The interesting thing about clinging is, even if it's unpleasant and we're trying to push it away, we can't push something away if we don't cling to it first. We've got to get a good, firm grip on it mentally so that we can then fling it out of our lives. Oh, I don't want that stuff. So, in either case, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, clinging arises. And then clinging leads to this sense of a separate self. It's called becoming, right? It leads to the space of this is mine, that's not mine. It always leads directly to a sense of self. So this is the cycle we go through over and over and over again as things arise at the level of the mind or at the body, at any of the sense doors. We react to the Vedana, and then we fall into this cycle and create more sense of self, which leads to creating more suffering, which leads to more causes and conditions arising, and here we go around again. I skipped a few steps there, but that's the essential idea. So it's really useful to look at the ways we cling. What is it we actually, what are the different ways we cling? So that we can, by being mindful, see, notice, oh, here I am clinging again. Or here I am about to cling. Hopefully, that's even better. Or here I've been caught in this morass of clinging for the last 30 years, which is also what happens, right? So it's like, who knows? So there are the four categories of things we cling to. Sense pleasures through objects, what's called views and opinions, rites and rituals, and a sense of self. These are the four classic subgroups of things we cling to. And I want to spend a fair bit of time now talking about these things we cling to. First of all, sense pleasure through objects. We somehow think that we can be happy just by having good stuff happen all the time. We somehow think that sense pleasures in and of themselves are going to make us always happy. And we get really good at it in the thought process of like, well, if I just get the right set of all these things, you know, the right partner, the right job, the right apartment, the right car, the right dog, the right whatever, the right diet, the right hobbies, whatever it is we think is important. If I can just get them all together at the same time, it'll be perfect. and I'll be happy. But duh, of course, as soon as we, even if we can achieve that moment where everything's together, the next moment things are changing, and those things that we thought we had all together fall apart for whatever reason. Causes and conditions are such that things are ch just changed. But we keep falling into this one. We keep, and it's the most obvious of the things we cling to. But it's also, it's like so deeply culturally taught that this is the way to be happy, is to get all this good stuff. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with enjoying yourself or having good stuff, by the way. You know, I just had a really wonderful supper before I sat down here, including apple crisp. Oh, I love apple crisp. Anyhow, whatever it is, you know, it's just like, you know, it's okay to enjoy yourself. But it's when we think, I can have apple crisp every day if I want to. Well, first of all, you get sick of it. But other than that, it's just not, doesn't work that way, right? So I want to read a couple of little things here. This is going to be a Joseph Goldstein night. I've got three different Joseph Goldstein books here. I'm going to read little bits from all of them. And this is a story he tells about someone named Mulla Nasruddin, a famous teaching figure. One day he went to the market and saw a big bushel of hot chili peppers on sale. He bought them, returned home, and began to eat. A little while later, his disciples came, saw the mullah with tears streaming down his face, his mouth and tongue burning. "Mullah, mullah, why do you go on eating them?" As he reached for another, Nasruddin replied, "I keep waiting for a sweet one." This is what we do. We keep waiting for the sweet one. It'll all work out somehow, you know. Even though it hasn't, it hasn't worked out the last 37 times, number 38, it's going to be the right one, and it's going to be perfect and wonderful, right? This is how this is a habit mind at work. And just it's just a great description of how we do things. This is a somewhat longer piece by Joseph, and this is from his book, Insight Meditation. And Joseph is very practical, and I think this is a very practical description here. We live in a world where we naturally encounter a wide assortment of appealing sense objects, sights and sounds, tastes, sensations, interesting thoughts and ideas. Desire arises from contact with these pleasing objects, and this desire can range from obsessive passion to addictive craving to a simple passing wish for something. All of these relations of feeling are expressions of the wanting mind. It is important to distinguish here between the desire of wanting associated with greed and the desire of motivation, which can be joined with other either wholesome or unwholesome factors. In English, we use the same word for these very different mind states, whereas in Pali, the language spoken by the Buddha, different words distinguish the various meanings of desire. In Pali, the word tanha means the desire of craving, whereas the word chanda is translated as desire to do. For example, the Buddha, before his enlightenment, had a strong desire for liberation that inspired him over countless lifetimes of practice. This chanda, this energy of motivation to accomplish something, in this case associated with faith, wisdom, and compassion. So desires can be extremely wholesome. They're what motivate us, in a sense, to keep practicing or to go deeper into our practice, right? The grasping force of tanha runs very deep in our consciousness. In fact, the The Buddha said that this kind of desire or craving is the driving force of samsara, this entire round of existence, of life and death. Desire, wanting, craving, clinging are all expressions of the greed factor in the mind. We feel it as a thirst for a particular object. We become entranced by the appearance and seduced by the pleasant feeling that accompanies it. At that time, we cannot clearly see the true nature of phenomena, their impermanence and selflessness. Observe carefully what happens to your mind when it becomes entranced in the forest of desire. It's like being lost in an enchanted maze or wrapped in a delusive dream world. We weave many thoughts and fantasies about the experience we either are having or want to have, and we bind ourselves in the chains of attachment. Strong desire in our mind not only obscures clear understanding, but also fails finally to deliver happiness it promises. We seek out different sense pleasures for the pleasant feeling they bring. These feelings are so impermanent that we need to look continually for another and another. This is also something if we start to look, we see the mind, you know, we got something. At the moment we get it, it's like, this is great. Oh, this apple crisp is just the best thing in the world. And then it's like, oh, now I gotta wash the dishes. Not so pleasant. You know, same, it's a process, right? And we keep looking for, how can I make doing the dishes fun, which is kind of fun to do sometimes. You know, you can actually enjoy doing the dishes. You can sort of feel like you're doing something useful and getting the house clean. And that's how I make doing the dishes sort of a happy event. I like having a clean kitchen, so. It is hardest to cure a disease when the medicine we take itself causes the disease. We scratch the itch, and scratching only makes it worse. We try to quench our thirst by drinking salt water, and we make ourselves thirstier. This is what happens when we believe that the only way to end desires is to fulfill them. This is the art teachings and definitely cults of various sorts, that this is the main teaching. If you want to be happy, just keep, excuse me, that'll be good on the recording. Just keep satisfying your desires. If you keep satisfying your desires, you'll run out of them eventually. Doesn't work, obviously. It's a different and liberating insight dawns when we begin to pay careful attention to this powerful energy in our lives. First, we need to make desire the very object of our attention so that we are fully aware when it arises in our mind. In this way, we are no longer simply lost in the feelings or thoughts, but instead see clearly what is going on. And this is, he's pointing very directly to mindfulness and the importance of using, being mindful and seeing tanha arise and going, oh, I don't have to do that. I don't need that. You know, I don't really need that second bowl of apple crisp, even though, you know, it would be nice. I know that would be not very healthy for me, so no second bowl. And that's just what we do. We have to learn to do. We have to see our mind going, I want that. And then we go, yeah, but, and make intelligent decisions. And it's tricky, these things, because they're so culturally accepted. It's like perfectly normal to want stuff and just indulge yourself. Try and make yourself happy by getting all this good stuff. I think I've mentioned before, I used to be in marketing and sales back in my businessman days. I was actually director of marketing. for a company. And every ad we ever did only ever said one thing. If you don't have this, you can't be happy. That's a good ad. That's every ad you ever saw says exactly that. If it doesn't say that, it doesn't work. And it says it in very subtle ways sometimes. But it's always saying that thing. You can't be happy if you don't have this. And we're told that over and over and over and over and over. Continually in our culture. What a surprise we keep falling into this one. But though, it's interesting, you know, 2,500 years ago when the Buddha was teaching this, you know, there wasn't any like advertising in that sense at all, but people still fell into it. So it's just like now we're just, it's easier. We get more encouragement to do it. That's all. Anyhow, enough about sense desires. The second one is a bit more subtle. We're getting into more purely mental. So views and opinions. We actually cling to our views and our opinions. And this is partly intellectual, like we figured things out and I know I'm right. And partly cultural in the sense of like, well, that's how I was brought up. It's always been that way. Everybody knows that's correct, right? And the problem with views and opinions is they always act like filters so that we don't ever see anything clearly. We see it in relation to our view of that sort of thing. Or our opinion that we've studied and come up with, we know what's right. And we don't see them because they seem so natural. Views and opinions seem like, well, of course. There's that of course vibe, okay? And so we really have to watch our mind when we are in the midst of something, some sort of process, particularly in the world, but also just in our own mind, thinking we've got it all figured out, right? Where we have this thought of the sort of like, well, of course it's that way. Or that's just the way it is. It's always been that way. When we have those thoughts, those are views and opinions masking reality. And it's like we have to constantly be questioning ourselves when we see those sorts of thoughts arise. Because we've always done it that way doesn't make it mean it's good now, good thing to do now, or ever was for that matter. It's just that's, you know, what we believe, you know, out of habit, out of how things are, that that's the correct way to do things. It's a tricky, tricky, tricky space because we're so habituated. You know, there's this great quote from the third Zen patriarch. He says, "Do not seek the truth, only cease to cherish opinions." Notice the word cherish there. I think it's really apt. Because often, especially our opinions, we cherish them. Like, I'm smart, I figured this one out, I got it down right, I know I'm right. And we cling to it, we cherish it, because aren't I... You know, it's part of our ego gratification. Like, aren't I great and smart? I've got this one all figured out. Only do not seek the truth. Only cease to cherish opinions. Stop clinging to your opinions. And this means that we have to, you know, the Dalai Lama has this great thing where he says, you have to, every time you're having, getting caught in some unpleasant mental space, stop, what am I clinging to? And then try and look at the same thing from six different angles. And see if that clarifies it. It'll broaden your understanding. And clarify it and say, yeah, this is what I've always believed, but here's what someone else says. And oh, look, here, and now you just start looking at things from all these different angles and you start to see that It's just an opinion. Doesn't mean it's true. Doesn't mean it's perfect. It's just your opinion right now. Your view right now. That's all it is. Okay. So that's the second thing we tend to cling to. Third one, and this is partly comes out of the culture of the time. The Buddha said we have to be very careful not to cling to rites and rituals. Well, in the Buddha's time, he grew up in a very in the you know the Vedic culture, with the where the Brahmins were in charge. It was like the classical Hindu culture, and things like something I ran into recently in another situation. If there's a man and a woman, you listen to the man because the woman is always subservient to the man. This is just something that's embedded in the culture, for instance, but all kinds of things. And there's also in the Buddhist time, the Brahmins, and this is still true today, by the way, in much of India, the Brahmins had a monopoly on knowing what was right because only they could read and study the scriptures, which told everything that was right. And they also were the only people who could perform the rituals for whatever was going on. We need rain for the crops. I want a son. I want my child to get better. I want to get married. I want you to bury my parents. Whatever it was, only the Brahmins could do it. And it was all based on rigid class structure and ritual. And the Buddha said, basically, nah, none of this is true. I mean, he was like really, like for his time, this radical troublemaker, as far as the Brahmins were concerned. Because he said, anybody can, can understand, and anybody can practice, including women, gasp, including divorced women, which in India at that time, if you were, I mean, I'm not divorced, if you were a widow, if you were a widow, you were like, you weren't second class, you were like fifth class citizens. You were a widow, you were just done. Too bad. And he just said no to all of that. He said you don't need rites and rituals at all, though there were within the Buddhist. In the Buddhist time, even there were, things that were chanted and things like that, like the three refuges. So there was this little tinge of ritual involved, but those rituals were always simple, and they are always there to remind us of the primary ideas of the teaching. So that's in the Buddhist time. What about now? How does this apply now? Well, first of all, this is. What I just described is going on every day right here in North America, let alone in India. There are lots of problems in with people who come from India to work here, and if you're not of the right class, you're not supposed to work with someone else who's like, there's still, class structure going on in the workplace, especially in the high-tech workplace. Apparently, this is a big issue that has to be dealt with. But I think more in our own culture, there's all this stuff that goes on in quote what I'll call the spiritual culture. That culture that says, there's more to life than just getting stuff. But then it has, just like any other culture, has these rituals and rites that are laid on top, these ideas that are laid on top of that culture, that sometimes can be quite harmful. The one that bothers me more than anything else is the one that says to people, especially people who are suffering, physically suffering, or having troubles in their lives or whatever, everything has a reason. And not only that, if you're suffering, it's because you deserve it. You caused this maybe in this lifetime, maybe in another lifetime, but you're just suffering the consequences of what you've done before. So you deserve this pain. And so everything has a reason, and not only that, you deserve it. But you combine those two together, creates unbelievable suffering for people. Unbelievable suffering for people. I talk to people all the time in my chaplain role at the hospital who are caught in these places, and just it's horrible for them because they believe there they are, because I spend most of my time in the cancer ward, that this is happening to them because they deserve it. There's a reason for this, and they have to accept that. And it's just like total nonsense. It's not true. But it's culturally very embedded in what goes on in our world. Go around Boulder and you'll hear people saying these sort of things all the time. All the time. And they're destructive and harmful. And they cause more suffering. And people cling. Ah, here's the real truth. People cling to these beliefs. They cling to them like they know they're right. Whether it's, in sort of the Buddhist, Hindu, hippie world, or even in, some, Christian cultures, and there's lots of different Christian cultures where you run into exactly the same thing. This is God's will. You just have to take it. I've run into that one too. And it's just, okay, I'm going to stop ranting because I've ranted enough about this, but I just see this way too often, and it just causes untold problems in the world. Ah, so what's the fourth, the last thing on the list? This is the hardest one to take in and the hardest one to understand in a sense. And that is this very distinct sense we have of a separate self. That somehow I'm separate from everything else. There's me and not me. And this, I want to read a little bit from Joseph here again. He's talking about this fourth. The fourth of the bonds, and the most subtle, the most deeply conditioned, is our attachment to the belief in self, in I, in me, in mine. The belief that there is some permanent entity in the mind body which is experiencing all of this. Because of this belief, and to satisfy the I, the self, we get involved in all kinds of unwholesome actions, all kinds of greed and hatred, all kinds of delusion for the gratification of the self, which isn't even there. Our attachment to the concept of self is so great that everything we do revolves around it, tying the bonds even tighter into this mass of pain. Had a teacher, Carol Wilson, who had this great one-liner that described this. She said, "What we believe, culturally, what we believe is with this sense of self. Not only do we believe we have a sense of self, but we have a pretty negative view of this sense of self." And the phrase she would use is, "I'm just a little piece of shit that the world revolves around." And that describes pretty much how what we start believing in very quickly, over and over and over again. Not only am I wrong, not only am I wrong, but the whole world revolves around me. There's me and not me. And it just causes untold suffering. This is related to And this is a slightly different language in a sense. It's called the craving for becoming. And Joseph explains this. This is from his book, Mindfulness. This kind of craving the Buddha spoke of goes even deeper than the craving for sense pleasures. It's called craving for becoming, for renewed existence. This is a very basic urge or desire to be. It is the desire for continuing existence, particularly in pleasant realms. Of course, we may or may not believe in rebirth and different planes of existence, although they are mentioned often in the Buddha's teachings. But we don't have to believe in them in order to experience this powerful craving for becoming. We can see it in the planning mind, in the act of imagining ourselves in some future situation. We might be planning for something at work or perhaps for our next vacation. It all starts with just a thought, and then weeks or months or even years later, a whole chain of thoughts and actions has materialized in our lives. Notice how often we get lost in mind fantasies of a future self. I'll do this, I'll go there. Losing ourselves in these projects is a manifestation of craving for becoming. And just think how often we spend time doing that. We're driving in the car. And instead of just sort of being in the car, driving in the car because we're going to go shopping, we're already at the shopping center. It's going to, oh yeah, I got to make sure that, they have that right kind of oranges that my wife likes, or whatever it is, our mind is. We're already there. And that's just like a really simple example. But that's how our minds tend to be off in the future, figuring out how things are going to be. And as if we're sure that we are going to be around to be there. Which is an interesting thought when you think about it, right? It's like a lot of that planning assumes that I'm going to wake up tomorrow morning. This is built into the assumptions. And we have to take that in, that we have no clue that that's true. Who knows? I mean, most likely, yeah, I'm going to wake up in the morning, but I don't know. I can't possibly know. And it's that we create that sense of self, of a separate self, through this idea of what's going to happen later. It's one of the ways we create a sense of a separate self really strongly, is in this craving for becoming. You see this also in beliefs that have to do with what's going to happen after we die. I'm going to be reborn. I, Barry, this entity called Barry, is going to be reborn. And there's going to be another Barry, maybe, hopefully, a better Barry, of course, because I've worked so hard this lifetime, right? Who's going to go on? I'm going to continue. Who knows? That's one of those who knows ones, as far as I'm concerned. I don't have enough clear information, but it's like, talk about clinging to this idea of a separate self. Not only am I separate now, but I'm going to be separate later. I'm going to continue. This is something that we, lots of people cling to. It's just all these ways, these are just ways we keep fooling ourselves. And believing that this is true. Now, at the same time, don't think for one second You have to believe what I just said about the sense of self. That in the sense of believe that it's true, that we are not separate. This is something of all the things we have to work with in this practice. This is the most difficult one to take in, and the only way we can take it in, to really take it in, is through experiencing. That's why, in the Satipatthana Sutta, the last set of instructions, it says to know as it really is, this is the arising of dukkha. The Buddha said that there he was sitting under the Bodhi tree, about to be enlightened, right? The last thing he had to let go of was a subtle sense of a separate self. This isn't something we're going to figure out tomorrow. This is something we just have to be aware of, that we fall into those habits of believing that we're permanent. Everything else is impermanent, but not me, boy. I'm permanent. That's what we often end up thinking. And it just causes us to suffer. There's this classic Indian teaching story, and it's actually also interesting that this is how in Asian countries they catch monkeys. It's called the monkey trap. And what they do is they take a coconut and they cut a hole in it that's just big enough for a monkey's hand to get inside. And then they attach a rope to one end and put some yummy thing in the other side that the monkey is going to want. So they got a rope holding onto one end of the coconut, but they're hidden behind a tree or something. And the monkey comes, sticks his hand in, and grabs what's there. But now, because he's grasped, the hand won't come back out. The hole's not big enough to hold onto this thing and pull the hand out at the same time. The monkeys won't let go. They'll cling to that thing. This is what we're doing. We're getting caught in the monkey trap all the time. We're clinging to things and then we can't get out. It's a great image. I like that. The reason I mentioned it only because I think it's a great image. And I also want to point out that even if we are really successful in noting carefully and mindfully all the ways we cling, which is a big project, it doesn't mean we're not going to have unpleasant experiences. We're still going to, the body's still going to get sick, it's going to wear out, you're going to have accidents, stuff's going to happen. It just means that you can see that clinging to things that are part of this whatever only make it worse. Inevitably make it worse. So you don't need to hold on to that thing inside the coconut. You just have to let it go and pull your hand out. Duh. And it makes things okay. Another way I like to describe this practice sometimes is we can't change what happens. Stuff is going to happen. All we're learning to do is to skillfully react to what's arising. It's a really good description of this practice, I think. We're just learning to skillfully react so we don't cling, or at least don't cling quite so often. Or if we are clinging, we catch it sooner. Even that'd be great if we just caught it sooner. it's a great progress, right? And that's what it is. It's little steps, little steps. We don't have to, it's like, we don't want to get caught in this idea that we have to be perfect. We're moving towards perfection. We're moving towards getting better. We're moving towards not being so reactive. If we can just do that, we're doing great, and the practice is having its effect. Course, I have a bit of poetry here just to finish off. And this is actually one of my favorite Dana Fald's poems from her book Going In In. It's called Being Present. She's describing very clearly, I think, how to be mindful. Breathe, relax, and feel. Take time to slow down the pace of life. Watch the rise and fall of moods, the birth and death of dreams. Feelings and sensations seem so real, yet they shift like changing clouds and flow with the high tide out to sea again. Allow it all to be, no need to grasp or push away. Present with each moment, the whole of you, body, mind, and soul, opens to receive. A pretty good description of mindfulness from my point of view.